I'm Deke Antrim, and this is my podcast, Sidetracked. Back in 1987, I was 12 years old, which is an age for any kid in which the movies they watch begin to really leave an imprint on how and what they view for years to come. RoboCop wasn't a movie to me. It was a force of nature, and anyone not prepared was about to be left behind, devastated. For this episode, we brought in our good friends Mark and Jared to help discover why this movie and its main character have lived on for almost 35 years as one of the most seminal films of all time. And afterwards, I hope you stick around for our exclusive interview with Dick Jones himself, actor and musician Ronnie Cox. As always, we speak our minds here on Sidetracked, and there are major spoilers ahead. You have been warned.
The future of law enforcement. RoboCop.
Thank you for your cooperation.
On today's show, the knight in shining armor who shoots perps in the genitalia gets the sidetrack treatment. Joining me now is my returning guest, Mark Talley. Mark, how are you doing today?
I'm good.
And borrowing him all the way from the Hyperspace podcast, Mr. Jared Talkstein. Jared, how are you doing today?
Well, I'm doing great.
Hey, guys, thanks for joining me for this. I want to dive right in. We have a lot to cover. I want to start with Jared. Let's talk sci-fi in the year 1987. That same year, we had Running Man, Predator, Spaceballs, Interspace. I know your personal favorite, Superman 4, The Quest for Peace. What did you think of RoboCop's extravagant entrance into the genre?
It was a multi-layered film, to put it mildly. The movies you just mentioned were family-friendly action-adventure films. There may be some overlap in some of the themes from Running Man with RoboCop, but certainly RoboCop took this satirization of the genre to a new level. It was both a condemnation of the 80s, but it totally embraced the excess of the 80s. Not only a great action movie on the surface, also a very smart, sharp, very pointed satire of corporate greed in the 1980s.
Had you ever seen the combination of such virile violence combined with comedy?
This is funny that you asked me that. The first time I saw RoboCop was in 1990. I saw it on TV, edited for television. And I'll just tell you now, if you have not searched out the TV versions of these scenes on YouTube, you have to, because it is an experience in itself. Just imagine the guy who holds up the convenience store screaming, "Why me? Why me?" But, you know, I think I finally saw it on VHS unedited, probably in 91 or 92. I recently watched it on the excellent Arrow release of the Blu-ray. It's got tons of extras. It's a great release. I actually saw RoboCop 2 in its entirety before I saw unedited RoboCop.
Wow. Was that because of the Kirshner?
When RoboCop 2 came out, that's why I watched RoboCop on TV. As a kid, I wasn't allowed to watch R-rated movies at home. So I would have to wait for them to come on TV and see them in their edited form. That happened to me also with Alien, Blade Runner, and a few others. Right. So I was introduced to these classic films edited on Saturday afternoon. The first time I saw unedited director's cut RoboCop was probably the late 90s on the Criterion release. Mm-hmm. You know, it is shocking as far as the amount of violence, even by today's standards. We've seen a lot in the past 30 or 40 years, but RoboCop, it makes an impression for sure.
There's really only three big violent scenes. The Ed 209 scene, you sense the build. Mm-hmm. You know something's going to happen. They're pushing that guy away, you know, from them. Murphy's destruction, and then Boddicker's. But they come at you like gangbusters. You do not expect it.
You just mentioned Murphy's execution. Were you able to recover after such a violent scene? Are you able to transition right back into it being a comedy again? The Ed 209 scene, you're able to do that because this guy's getting splattered all over the meeting table. And it just goes on and on and on and on. But then they go right into, it was just a glitch.
Even the elevator scene right after that, they're seemingly in business with this guy, partners. And they're just like, "Oh, hey, well, it's a tough break about so-and-so." Right. And he's like, "Oh, life in a big city." I'm like, what?
That's how you get it. You see an opportunity, you take it. I'm like, you just walked over his dead corpse to get to the old man. What the fuck?
So, the guy was like twitching on their like model. Yeah. Like, come on.
I would say the execution of Murphy was like the most violent scene in the movie, in my opinion. Are you able to transition back into being a comedy?
I'm definitely with Jared. I saw it on TV first, and you knew something was happening because it felt a little choppy.
Yeah. The TV version of that scene is all like super close-ups. It's like, you know, it ends with a close-up on just Murphy's open eye. Right, you don't see any of the stuff around him.
What struck me on this viewing for doing this was that practical, complete mock-up of Peter Weller as the camera did that dolly around him. I didn't remember that that was a total mock-up of him.
The Botine chest?
Yeah. I watched it this time with the 4K stream on Apple. I just didn't see the clarity of that prosthetic, whatever you call it.
The bust and Peter Weller's fantastic work.
It's amazing. It's incredible work.
It looks like a chunk of his skull.
Oh, yeah.
Now, here's one thing. I remembered his hand going away because I remember you talked about that in your Blade Runner podcast, talking about it made you throw up. But when, I did not I did not remember that he gets his entire arm blown off.
Yeah, and the director's cut.
Right after that. No remember of that. I sat up and was like, oh, my God. And with Jared, I do not remember seeing this uncut until I was kind of the age to process it. So I'm kind of glad of that, to tell you the truth.
What's interesting, though, is that RoboCop is in his final robotic form. It is something that appeals to little kids because my first intro to RoboCop was the arcade game. That side scroller, and he keeps saying, drop it, drop it. You're coming with me.
I remember that.
And that was my intro. I knew it was a movie, but I wasn't allowed to see it. The video game was my introduction to RoboCop. There's all this iconography, like Ed 209, associated with it that a little kid, especially a little boy, is fascinated with. It's like robots and guns. You can look at movies from that era that don't hold up design-wise. But I think even today, that RoboCop design, it still works. It's like a walking tank. It's fantastic.
It's one of those things that no matter if you see it in an updated like Mortal Kombat game recently or a KFC commercial, throughout the years, anything that you've seen with RoboCop.
Pro wrestling.
Yeah, pro wrestling. he is an iconic figure. And you're right, he never gets old. His design obviously had to be mulled over by a million people and probably people doing a lot of checklists and stuff, but final design is badass and always has been, and I've loved it since I was a kid. Mark, you had mentioned Verhoeven. I wanted to know where you stand with his career.
I'm a fan of when he broke out and then maybe like two more.
Gotcha.
Like that's really it. I can't say I'm a fan of Showgirls, even though it's fun to watch. The Spike TV broadcast was a great thing because of when they painted the bikini tops. Come on, that's insane on its own. He actually made a movie with Rutger Hauer right before this called Flesh and
Blood. Flesh and Blood.
And I kind of want to see it now.
It is in English, but he didn't shoot it in America. It's crazy, man.
From what I could see, it looked insane. Jennifer Jason Leigh and Bruno Kirby. Like what?
It's even got a naked Nancy Cartwright, the voice of Bart Simpson. So okay. She has to teach like Jennifer Jason Leigh how to have sex. You're like, what the fuck am I watching, dude?
Well, I don't know if you can tell, but I'm vigorously typing on my keyboard on the other window to try to find this thing. No,
I don't know if that's a selling point or a deterrent.
Well, I did want to see it, but I don't know now. RoboCop definitely was his breakout American movie. And he immediately follows it up with Total Recall. Yeah. I mean, come on. Basic Instinct with Joe Esterhaus, and Jan de Bont did the cinematography. Right. Joe Esterhaus, a Hungarian, wrote the script. And then, of course, Verhoeven directed. So you have three European filmmakers through their lens, weirdly noir-inspired potboiler whodunit that is so overdone, but yet steeped in detective story roots. You have Jerry Goldsmith doing the score, and he did Chinatown. After that, he did LA Confidential. So he's like steeped in that type of feel. When you boil away all of the controversial stuff that Basic Instinct got noticed for, it's a fun watch.
I love Basic Instinct.
Yeah, it's a great
little
movie.
Garbage film, but I love it. It's one of my favorite rated R soap operas. I fucking love
it's
that movie.
It's so over the top. Even Michael Douglas is doing stuff way beyond like what he normally does.
But it's captivating and it's a great thriller.
Yeah. Hollow Man, I don't really remember anything about that movie. I saw it once and it's really not memorable.
Jared, what's your stance on Starship Troopers?
RoboCop, Total Recall, and Starship Troopers form a Verhoeven sci-fi trilogy. Very similar themes. They work on different levels. You have the satire and the subversive messaging that's wrapped in the guise of an action movie. Those three are my favorite Verhoeven films.
I'm a half-decent fan of his. I like some of his other works. I've seen Black Book with a girl from Game of Thrones. Did see Soldier of Orange. I mean, he's a very auteur director. The last thing I wanted to say about him, he's never done a single sequel. No sequel or remake of any of his works are better than his original vision. And that goes for everything. That's RoboCop had sequels and remakes. Basic Instinct had a sequel. Total Recall had a remake. Starship Troopers has had sequels. Showgirls had a sequel. Hollow Man had sequels. I will say, as far as his original vision, he's never been topped in any of the remakes or sequels that have been done. He was originally doing a sequel to Total Recall that he was developing himself, and it actually turned out to be Minority Report.
Oh, yeah, really? Wow.
Got changed. Wow. Into that. Yeah.
I didn't know that. That's interesting. You know, that makes sense. I can see that actually. Yeah.
Same author. So let's move on to the crew. I want to talk about Basil Poradoris. He's done Hunt for Red October, Starship Troopers, Red Dawn. I know, Jared, you're a big fan of the Conan movies. He did those. As far as I'm concerned, this is one of the most memorable theme songs in film history. I mean, you hear it and you automatically know who's going to be walking down the block. Are you guys a fan of his scores? And how does this compare to some of his other works?
If you're asking me, I think Conan is my favorite of his. RoboCop, it's right in the Poradoris sweet spot. It's memorable. Every time I see this movie, I end up humming the theme for like weeks afterwards. Yeah. I have a funny story about that. Back when RoboCop 2 was released, I was reading Starlog magazine.
Oh, you beat me to it, man. I was about to mention Starlog.
So in the article in that magazine about RoboCop 2, the composer on RoboCop 2 was a man named Leonard Rosenman.
Oh,
he is infamous in the Star Trek world for composing Star Trek 4, which is essentially a Christmas album. There's our good buddy Mike, that's a co-host with me, hates Leonard Rosenman like no one else. In this article, Rosenman takes a dump all over Poradoris's score. He's like, it wasn't melodic. And I'm thinking, dude, what are you talking about? And this is the guy who, on his soundtrack to RoboCop 2, has a choir chanting in the end credits, RoboCop, RoboCop. It's ridiculous. This is why I think one of the reasons the score to RoboCop is in my brain, because I remember reading this article and thinking, you are crazy. RoboCop.
The only two Leonard Rosenman scores I'm aware of are Star Trek 4 and the boxy Lord of the Rings.
He did one of the old Planet of the Apes movies as well.
Oh, did he?
But forget that guy. Poradoris, top marks for RoboCop. There are several great special edition soundtracks out there. You should definitely seek out if you're a fan of the score.
I got the vinyl and I love it.
It's fantastic.
There's a lot of anvil work back then. Between Terminator and RoboCop, man, you got your anvil covered.
Yeah. I gotta have more anvil.
I need more anvil.
I'll say something too. Rosenman can say it's not melodic, and maybe the only true theme is the RoboCop march, anvil included. But every time there's those visual callbacks or audio callbacks of Lewis saying, Murphy, Murphy, it's you.
Right.
And him kind of looking, and you hear that like, doo-doo-doo, that little theme, three or four notes every time he has a memory that plays. And it's a great cue to pull the audience into something's going on in his brain.
A lot of the characters get their own themes and they get woven in perfectly to each other. I love the score. I think it's fantastic.
He also did the score for the TV miniseries Lonesome Dove, which is gorgeous. It's one of his unsung things like nobody really talks about. It's kind of different than the other stuff that he's done. Like, if Rosenman wants some lyrical stuff, he should listen to Poradoris's Lonesome Dove score.
So, Jared, let's talk Phil Tippett. He doesn't do stop motion. He does what's called go motion. He's known for doing Ed 209. He's been nominated for 6 Oscars. He won for Jurassic Park and Return of the Jedi. He did the Arachnids in Starship Troopers. He directed Starship Troopers 2. What is your deep history with this man?
For those who don't know, I'm a huge Star Wars nut. I first became aware of Phil Tippett watching the original Star Wars trilogy. He animated the walkers. He animated the characters on the chessboard in the Millennium Falcon. He has a deep history with stop motion and later go motion, which they really cracked go motion on the movie Dragon Slayer.
And the Oscar goes to Dennis Muren, Stan Winston, Phil Tippett, and Michael Lanteri for Jurassic Park.
Phil Tippett being usurped from Jurassic Park as CG really came into being. But the one thing they found they needed Phil Tippett for, the computer animators didn't understand how dinosaurs moved. And Phil Tippett, through his long history with creatures and robots, he understands how these things move. So he got a new job and kind of a new lease on life on that movie, showing them how to do it, how to make them look real. Stop motion, people are now recognizing it as an art form and not necessarily as a tool of necessity that they have to use in movies. Because if you want to make something look alive, stop and go motion definitely has limitations. Now people are recognizing it as more of an art form. You go back to the Tim Burton Nightmare movies. They look a certain way, but that's the way they're designed to look. And Phil Tippett has just released a new stop motion film.
Yeah, he's been working on for years.
Yes. So he's still doing it. I think his work in RoboCop is really fantastic because Ed 209 moves a certain way because he's a robot. And you can kind of get away with that slight herky-jerkiness or very mechanical walking. It's kind of the way that the walkers in Empire and Jedi look. That works because those are giant machines. They move a certain way. And Ed 209 is very similar. I think it works because Ed 209 is a droid. The one part that stands out just a little bit is when RoboCop stop motion enters the frame fighting with Ed 209. Yeah. That is something that as a modern viewer, you can look at and say, yeah, I don't know if technically if that holds up. For me now, watching that, there is a charm to it. That's how they made RoboCop fight Ed 209. That's the tools they had back then. And it looks great.
I would say the fight sequences for me are totally believable. I mean, you know, 50% of them are done in stop motion, and between realistic props that are in the foreground of the shot to blend between the cuts of the stop motion and RoboCop getting fired missiles at or guns fired at, anytime Ed 209 was involved, I believe the fight's hook, line, and sinker.
Yeah, there's a fluidity to it that they wouldn't have been able to achieve if they had done the comp shot or the rear projection shot like all the other things when Ed 209 walks in front of people. Would have looked really weird if Peter Weller was kind of removed a little bit.
I love the fact that he can't navigate stairs. That defeats him. Steps.
The little toe flopping was like,
That was all Phil Tippett's idea. That goes back to him being able to give his puppets a real personality.
Pig noises when it can't get up and it's just squealing.
When it's about to attack, it sounds like a lion growling something.
So good. Effective as hell.
Anytime we get together, it just basically turns into the Roboteam podcast. He did the RoboCop suit, the Murphy bust, and the Melting Man. What's your thoughts on his work on this film?
Everything in 4K totally holds up. Movies are time capsules anyway. Mm-hmm. Like Jared said, it's the tools they had to work with. Peter Weller sells the rest of it by the movements inside.
Oh, man.
I mean, he's insane. Even when Murphy is picking him up and he's kind of looking around all robotic. And he was hot off the heels of Buckaroo Banzai when he did this right after. So he's just sci-fi king going from one to the other. But anyway, Botine, the gore effects.
The Toxic Man.
Botine did that. That's amazing. And don't get me started on that wet splatter all over Boddicker's windshield.
Yeah, he just pops like a water balloon. Yeah.
God, it's disgusting.
Yeah, that's all him, man.
I'm going to take Jared's advice and go look up the TV stuff. I need to see how they cut that. That's insane.
I definitely want to bring up the director of photography, Jos Vacano. Most recognized for his camera work in Das Boot. He basically created a whole new camera with Ari, super small and compact. He was able to run in those holes all the submarine workers are just darting through and he's following them. He was also the DP on Starship Troopers and that shower sequence. Him and Paul Verhoeven shot that scene naked.
I've heard about that. In 88, my family moved to Dallas, which was a year after RoboCop, and they shot this movie in Dallas-Fort Worth area, or at least the exteriors, which is funny because it's in Detroit, but you can clearly see a Texas Industries sign on a building during the car chase shootout. And I paused it and was like, oh my God, yes. Even as a kid, we would go into the city and go to the mall and I'd be like, it's a building from RoboCop. Things I'll always associate with this. I don't know if it was being in Dallas that made this movie sort of stand out for me and seeing these landmarks that you see in the background of the movie, but this movie's got a special place for me and I haven't seen it in years. And it was great to revisit it.
You guys have any call outs for the cast? I thought everyone did a great job. I thought Peter Weller was fantastic. We've talked about some of his movements in the suit were amazing.
Peter Weller, he's 6'1". He's not a short man. He seems like a very slight guy. He doesn't have a very big build. When he's in that suit, he looks like a linebacker. And I know it was difficult for him in that suit. It was hard on him physically. When he's first in that suit, some of his neck movements are not human. The way he moves his neck, it's like he almost looks back behind him. His physicality in that suit is amazing.
Mark, I know you and I have talked a million times about Nancy Allen. How would you think she did in this movie?
I love her badass intro, beating up that perp. She's just great in anything she does. She brings the innocence to it, even though she's this badass cop. Yeah. She's the one that sees through the suit. She sees Murphy. She recognizes Murphy. She brings out his humanity.
I would say she teams up really well with Basil Poradoris' score. Anytime she has like these touching moments, whenever she's speaking and she's trying to reach through to the real Murphy and trying to get to his real identity, backed up with that score, I think it's some of the more powerful moments in the movie for sure.
Yes, excellent.
And then one last person I want to touch base, Kurtwood Smith, man. Oh, that motherfucker. Yeah. Jesus God, man.
Kurtwood Smith. Jeez. He is always playing some degree of a dick. Like always.
Yeah, but he kills
Dead
in this
Poet
one,
Society, That 70s Show. They're all just little versions of this dickish guy. Mm-hmm. And this one's like the king.
Cops don't like me.
Oh my God. He has such an impact in his opening scene. Can you fly, Bobby? Yeah. I can't tell you how many times I've said that. Just apropos of nothing in my life.
Oh, no. Anytime I hear the name Bobby in my head, I'm literally saying, can you fly, Bobby?
Oh,
like every
amazing.
Single time.
You burn the fucking money. Like, it's so good.
He starts out of the gate like 120 miles per hour. I mean, he's like kicking cast members. And
yes, and it's that one scene, and he's not in the movie for another like 45 minutes. Mm-hmm. You're just reminded of Boddicker as being a character in the movie because RoboCop starts having his memories back. Other than that, like, they've left him out for a good chunk of the movie, and mm-hmm. it's insane how much of an impact that his performance as Boddicker has. He's awesome.
You remember the physical things he does, whether he's spitting blood, which was his idea. He spits on the paperwork he's supposed to do. He's putting gum on nameplates.
Oh, that's...
I even noticed this time, he breathes his cigarettes out through his nose like a dragon. He is very physical with his performance. I can't stand when villains are underwritten. It's a complete off balance for the film. If you're going to have something as outspoken visually as the RoboCop outfit, you have to have villains that can sit in the same seesaw as them and match them in the movie. And you have to be actually scared of those villains. And if they're just human beings without a huge robotic fucking suit to them, they have to be able to stand up to RoboCop. And I was scared shitless of all the villains in this movie, and they are a complete counterbalance to how awesome RoboCop is. And mm-hmm. a lot of that I credit to Kurtwood Smith for sure.
Oh yeah, and you can feel all his goons just playing off of him. All those guys
just trying to keep up with him. Yeah,
and doing their own thing.
He can make you feel uncomfortable watching him. When he talks to that secretary, he just might kill her when she's off work.
Well, it's his wife, so I doubt that.
Oh, that's his wife in real life? Yeah. Oh my God, that's amazing. Okay, because I was like, what a pickup line. You can keep the gum. I know. Whatever he says, like, God.
Apparently did end up fitting him in. So they got it. Oh.
Bitches leave.
Oh my God, that's the best. When he just walks in and says that, I was like, oh my God.
Even just like him pulling the grenade pin with his tongue, he's a very visual actor. You remember all these things that he does. He's a very standout character.
All he says in that scene is he walks in and says, bitches leave. He doesn't say a damn thing mm-hmm. to Miguel Ferrer after that. He just shoots him in the leg.
He starts drinking his wine, doing his coke.
Puts in the CD and just pulls the pin and walks out. It's awesome. Yeah, he's another level in this movie.
I think he stands up to RoboCop big time. Uh-huh. Let's jump into the meat of the movie. It was nominated for 3 Oscars. It won for Best Sound Editing. It had a budget of $13 million versus $56 million gross take back from the box office. So it was a pretty big hit at the time.
I do remember seeing in the theaters the standees.
Oh, yeah.
The standees were really cool.
Where he's coming out of the car.
They were three-dimensional. He's standing up out of the car, and they were giant. Yeah. You see these in theaters.
And trailers, too. We'll get to this in the John Carpenter Part 3, but... Dude, in front of like Big Trouble in Little China, this trailer was there. I distinctly remember.
The original trailer actually had the Terminator score.
Really? That makes sense with the anvils.
Yes.
RoboCop, the future of law enforcement.
Orion had done really well with Terminator. It was a huge hit. When they purchased RoboCop, they really wanted to build upon that. Actually, Schwarzenegger was supposed to play the role that Peter Weller took. Both team talked him out of it. He will not fit in this suit. There's no fucking way.
Is the suit.
Yeah.
That suit would have been 8 feet tall and 7 feet wide.
Just spray paint him silver.
If you think about it, so 87 had Running Man and Predator, and had Schwarzenegger done RoboCop in that same year, fucking game over, man. That's the turkey shoot right there.
Hold on. Schwarzenegger did Running Man and Predator in the same year?
In 87. And had he done RoboCop.
Awesome.
That's box office king for life right there, man. That standee is taken from the poster. Did you guys know that's actually not a photograph? That's actually a painting?
Really?
No, I didn't know that. Can you fucking believe that? My entire life, I've always grown up with that poster. It's actually a painting, man. It's unbelievable to me.
That's crazy.
It's the same guy who did the Platoon poster. That's actually a painting, not a photograph.
It's a fantastic poster.
I want to talk about the fast-paced opening. Right off the bat, you have the news break in, which is the opening scroll from Star Wars. It catches you up. It gives you a quick, brief history, and it aids you in the understanding of the plot. And it goes straight from that right into Murphy's entrance to the locker room, which has gender fluidity. If you watch the camera work in that locker scene, it's just going back and forth, back and forth. Yeah. And then that goes right into the dead officer nameplate switch out and Sergeant Reed talking about no strikes. In the first couple seconds of the fucking movie, you feel like you've entered into hell. To say the Ed 209 sequence is your first time you catch a breath, what does that say about a movie? movie right there.
You're talking about the news breaks. That film is the first time that I can remember that plot was communicated to you in that way. You are a person in that world who's watching television. And it's something, of course, that Verhoeven went back to. But if I'm just sitting here thinking off the top of my head, I can't think of another that put the news front and center, like filled the movie screen with this news break.
Right.
I was producing a show with Lisa Givens. And during our pre-pro meeting, I told her, I was like, I really enjoyed you in RoboCop. And her face like lit up. And right. She's yes. like, oh, that was so much fun. She's like, it's 100 years ago, but really loved doing that.
I felt like you were building up to her just looking at you dead, not even reacting. And I was like, oh no, please, no.
Can't remember exact contents of our conversation, but she really enjoyed it and she loved to talk about it.
You had a great reaction with her. That can always be a little dicey. When I stage managed for Florence Henderson, I brought up that I'm a huge fan of Shakes the Clown, which is the Bobcat Goldthwait movie, in which in the opening sequence of the movie, she starts off by urinating on him because he's a drunk, passed out clown. And she looked at me like I was in fucking sane. Oh. Sometimes, again, you have some good reactions and sometimes some bad reactions. So it's, you just never know.
Oh, man.
Everyone else on the floor had gone up and talked to her about Brady Bunch, and I'm bringing up the drunk clown movie she did that she's probably not that proud of.
I introduced myself. She thought I said Jerry. So she was calling me Jerry. This gentleman that we used to work with, he heard her say this, and she had called me Jerry for a few minutes. And he goes, hey, Florence, his name is Jared, not Jerry.
Oh, my God.
And she said, Jared, why did you say anything? And she goes, Jared is a way better name than Jerry. And I was like, thank you. Yes. What do you think about Shanks the Clown?
Okay. She's like, okay, Jerry.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah. We're off the rails here. I'm sorry about that.
Hey, let's talk about Lewis and Murphy. They're one of my favorite on-screen ride-or-die partnerships. Mark, you had mentioned earlier about Lewis's intro, and I want to go back to that because you don't know if it's a guy or girl. It's this person who's getting beat up, and she rebounds. She's smashing the guy's face in with her fists, and then she pulls her helmet off. Verhoeven wanted this to be a very gender-neutral film, so he cut her hair and had her put on a little weight and actually did not want the two of them to have any kind of sexual chemistry whatsoever. And she's just as fucking badass as Murphy right off the top.
I better drive until you know your way around.
I usually drive when I'm breaking in on your partner.
It's this great partnership of these two who are going to probably be trying to outdo each other, which I like at the beginning, but then they go through this hell of a nightmare sequence.
Like I spoke earlier about the visual language of the film and not just shots that are set up. I feel like there's a lot of this movie that could be a comic book. Every shot is pretty much like a comic book panel. And honestly, I feel like this is kind of like the unsung comic book film. There's Dutch angles. It's very like Riddler's Lair.
Literally,
you know,
Dutch angles.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there you go.
Every angle is technically a Dutch angle in this movie.
That's true. Even though it's super quick, their relationship, it has an impact. And like you're saying, it's like one of the screen best pair-ups. Peter Weller has these looks at her like, huh, you know, and they just see this familiarity between each other, almost like they're equals. And that's what draws them together.
Towards the end, and I'm kind of fast forwarding a little bit, where Nancy Allen is helping him recite his gun. Just touching moments, man. And I think they have just this really great chemistry. They don't need to be a sexually attractive couple to each other. They kept talking about how they were trying to eliminate the chemistry in that aspect. I don't really care because as far as I was concerned, Lewis would never leave him. She stays till the end to help him out. I think it's a great partnership.
Her first impact when he's in the firing range and they're like, oh, it's a super cop. She sees that gun twirl. Mm-hmm. And that's another visual language beat where you see him doing it right when Miguel Ferrer's Bob says some poor schmuck has to volunteer, and it cuts right away to him doing the gun twirl. It's just close up on the twirl. So it's like, you cannot miss it. And then she sees it and immediately that Polidorus Q comes in. She knows who it is. And, you know, they don't let anybody near him, really. So she has to wait until that chance thing where he walks by her to really reconnect with him. Perfectly done, perfectly executed.
A movie of that era, and maybe even nowadays, there would have been some push to get them together somehow, however that would work.
Well, in the second draft, Verhoeven actually wrote in for them to have an affair. They had to explain to him. They were like, that totally negates the memory of when he goes back to the house and he's having memories of his wife and children. Exactly. That totally X's that out. He had to be talked out of that.
You know, in the 80s, if there were a man and a woman on the screen, then they were romantically involved somehow. Mm-hmm. And it was unique in that way, that was presenting this caring, platonic relationship between those two characters.
They're a total Butch and Cassidy all the way to the end, and they're willing to die for each other. You get the sense that they're there for each other in a short period of time, and I credit that to Verhoeven. Let's move on to the Ed 209 sequence.
The enforcement droid, Series 209, is a self-sufficient law enforcement robot. 209 is currently programmed for urban pacification, but that is only the beginning.
This fucking thing is 30 feet tall. Why would this thing be just for urban pacification? After Mr. Kenny gets assassinated 1,000 times over, he gets turned into pure Chuck.
Dick, I'm very disappointed.
I'm sure it's only a glitch. A temporary setback.
You call this a glitch? We're scheduled to begin construction in 6 months. Your temporary setback could cost us $50 million in interest payments alone.
What's really funny about that sequence, you think that he cares about Mr. Kenny, but he doesn't. He actually goes into this whole conversation about how he's outraged that his mistake is going to cost millions and it's going to set them back on their timetable. And they're having this whole conversation with this dead corporate worker in the background, just raw meat.
All the workers in the back are just like scattering.
Oh, they're freaking out. Get an EMT.
Oh, when Bob says, somebody call a paramedic, I was like, right.
Well, how about a hearse?
Did you see that? Yeah. Call a shovel.
Yeah.
Man. A snow shovel.
It looked like chunks of canned ham just coming out of him.
And that guy who gets killed, he's always there. When you see Bob and the other friend clapping, he's right there. And I was like, well, they're really taking pains to show this guy. I was like, oh, wait, this is the guy who takes the gun.
I want to talk about the reveal of RoboCop. This movie, for me, really subscribed to the Jaws school of the slow reveal. When you're trying to introduce your audience to something that could be very shocking, if you're just to come right out and show it, that can really dishearten your audience from continuing to watch. I like how they started off with the heavy footsteps sound effects, and then they move into the frosted glass pan across of him walking, the cops running down the hallway like Beatlesmania. And you can tell something that has never been seen before is in the building. Their reactions is kind of a big part of the reveal of RoboCop. And then they do that 360 Vulcanus shot of just going around the fencing, and you're still seeing them, but it's still obscured because of the fencing's in foreground. I just really like that slow reveal, and I thought that was like a real cool way to introduce such an iconic character to the audience for the first time.
You'd get a glimpse of him on a video monitor right after he gets out of the chair, but it's real fast.
Even before that, the POV montage is a great buildup. You can see the trace lines of the CRT, and then the guy with the drill and the grid that's like slowly coming back as he drills.
What I was just talking about as far as the lead-in to introducing the audience to RoboCop, it's the same thing. POV cameras can be disorientating, so they even started introducing some sample shots of that in the ER sequence. Fantastic fucking camera work, but they started plugging in a couple of the POV shots, so it starts introducing the audience and warming them up for the next sequence, which is going to be strictly only POV for the next 5 minutes. Yeah. They keep easing the audience in visually, and I thought that was amazing.
Yeah, and around the frosted glass scene, the desk sergeant. Hey,
what is this all about?
Who's this guy?
Sergeant John. What's this all about?
It's about official OCP business, so please, get lost.
I think we got 4 or 5 days set up.
Hey, this is bullshit! I take my orders from...
As soon as he sees RoboCop through the frosted glass, he shuts the hell up. And to me, that is like a huge cue. It's like, oh, what's going on? It's perfectly done.
We keep talking about the pacing and how this story can keep advancing forward and it never slows down. When you're trying to establish the rules of the world that you're building and you need to get out that information so quick, I think RoboCop does a fantastic job. You know everything in the first 10 minutes of the introduction. You have that robotic hand grip that Bob Morton is shaking hands, and they talk about how many foot pounds the hand does. And that's your first introduction of what RoboCop can possibly do and what he's going to possibly look like. That goes into the prime directives. And so now you know what he's supposed to be doing. And that goes into his scanning abilities. You know that he himself can be tracked. You know he has a badass gun. You know that he supersedes the police department. You understand how important it is for him to succeed for Miguel Ferrera's character. You even know what his poop looks like. You know every single thing you need to know about RoboCop going into his first missions. And I love that they establish the rules like that. I think it's a great way to get a lot of fun and interesting information for you to take on the journey you're about to take with RoboCop.
They do a lot of that exposition in a lot of their tracking work, like that opening tracking shot, kind of piggybacking off of the news breaks. You hear them talking about OCP and how they're like sponsored and how that's kind of this thing where now it's like, well, do they have union representation? The guy with the towel slams the door and he's just like, oh, we're dropping like flies or whatever he says. And even in that scene, you're getting all the information you need about RoboCop down to the baby food. And then the shot ends with the shot ends with the guy like, hey, this tastes like baby food. And he keeps eating it. Like they
That always struck me as strange. It's like, that's nasty. What are you doing?
And they stay with like three more dips of the finger. And I'm like, oh.
I mean, offer it to the other guy, but don't eat it yourself.
Oh, yeah. He's like, you knock yourself out. It's like, yeah, it's great.
There was a brief scene when they're working on him where they say, you got to ditch the arm. He's like, we agreed on full body prosthesis. Literally, what I'm thinking, the only thing on that still him is his head and his brain. He's got his face still as kind of a nerd. I thought that was interesting, that essentially RoboCop is just his head and his brain, and he needs that nourishment to nourish what organic elements are left.
What does he say? A rudimentary paste
to
keep alive his organic elements.
When you take so much of his actual human form away and you replace it with so many mechanics, this movie is a stolen identity film. And so for him to get back his actual identity and find himself coming back to being Murphy, it adds more to that tension when you're taking more and more of his actual human form away. The next thing I want to talk about is RoboCop's first missions. Again, we keep talking about the pacing and the pacing and the pacing. It never slows down. You don't catch your breath with this pretty short film. It's a quick run. I think it's only like a buck 43, if I remember correctly. And he goes into that convenience store.
Thank you for your cooperation. Good night.
I'll buy that for a dollar.
Quick question, the guy who hides all his money in that safe, every time he does his nightly drop, does he have to rebuild that entire wall of beer cans? What the fuck, man? That seems like a lot of work.
Yeah, he's got a lot of time on his hands. He's old.
Maybe find like a wall painting instead, but not like a wall of beer cans.
And it's out in the middle of the store. You put the safe there.
I know,
And all he does is run that store and watch the I'd buy that for a dollar.
Yeah, exactly.
And then he goes into the rapist sequence. That scene was written by Verhoeven. And that was his idea to shoot the guy in the junk. This movie is so funny that it actually makes that horrible rape sequence super funny to watch.
The funniest beat in that is when she rocks up to him and it's like, oh, thank you. And hugging this like cold exterior. And he just looks
notify
down
a rape crisis center.
Ma'am, you have suffered an emotional shock. I will notify a rape crisis center. I laughed so hard at that. I did not remember that. It is such a funny beat.
You take these surreal, horrible situations where these people are getting fired upon by multiple machine guns or these people who are getting raped. The dialogue really sets you back to this movie is actually a super dark, dark, dark comedy. That sequence goes right into the scene where RoboCop pulls the city councilman through the layers of drywall punches him through the second story window. And Jared, you had talked about some of the news breaks and how the media is part of the comedy of this movie. That whole sequence is so fucking funny already. But then when the councilman goes flying out the window, they take a shot of a local cameraman who does a speed tilt down with the falling body. And then flash cuts to Lisa Gibbons. RoboCop, who is he? What is he?
And she laughs. Oh, she's my like, God.
And they replay him jumping out the window again. And it's just so fucking funny, man. It is stacked with just back-to-back-to-back-to-back memorable sequences. It's hard to keep up with this film.
The Negotiator is hilarious.
Yeah, I'll throw in a free blah punk. Like,
I remember my dad had a block put in his van. And I was like, hey, I know what that is. You know?
It's funny because that dude keeps popping up.
Right.
Like he'll pop up at the end when the whole police force is now mirroring Boddicker's gang, shooting him down and turning on their own. And he's just like, hey, we got orders to shoot him down. I mean, it's the same guy. Just okay, let's do it. I love the politician, all of his demands. Apply them not just to the excess of the 80s, but to now. I mean, he actually says, because it's the guy that lost the position. Right. He goes, I want a recount. And no matter what the outcome, I want my old job anyway. And it's like, it's so applicable to right now. And it's just so funny. We can't break that cycle of just constant repetition. Freaking Verhoeven and Ed Neumeier and all them, they just tapped right into it.
Man, I got to tell you, between Tech Noir from Terminator and that dance club, when Ray Weiss gets his gun kicked out of his hand and just random dancer just catches it and just keeps on dancing, I was like, Jesus, so these guys party hard, man. So fucking funny. Love it. It doesn't even phase them or their dancing that there's a guy getting pulled out by his hair, too.
Like, nope, they just fill the frame once again. Yep. So funny.
Dick Jones was probably not going to kill Barb Morton if the bathroom sequence hadn't gone down. If he wasn't caught talking shit about him, I don't think he would have been executed so violently.
You know what the tragedy is here, Bob? We could have been friends.
With that being said, what do you think happened to Bill, the guy who started the conversation? Hey, I heard Jones is plenty pissed.
After he kind of peed his pants.
Right, yeah, peed his pants and left the bathroom.
Oh, man, who knows? Maybe he was such a peon that Dick Jones didn't even know who the hell he was. Maybe off camera, Boddicker got one of his goons to go.
Yeah, maybe he got his hooker and cocaine party interrupted.
Maybe he didn't get a grenade going. I agree with you. I think that if he hadn't badmouthed him, maybe he would have survived.
I just want to know if Bill survived or not. That's all I'm concerned about.
Yeah, yeah. I will say Ronnie Cox is pretty funny in that scene, too, because he was like, yeah, I called the old man a name or two. Iron butt.
Right.
Boner. Like, what? That's the best you could do. Right. Once I even called him asshole. Like, what?
That's another edited for television moment. Oh, once I even called him something worse.
Really? They put in something worse?
Oh. Yes. Let's jump into the Industrial Factory Showdown. It is one of my favorite locations and showdowns. This is really where Yos Vakano has some amazing camera work. There's some sequences where they're tracking Clarence Boddicker's car where they start up super high. And as they're tracking him going like 60 miles per hour, they're booming down into his window. They were able to capture happy accidents like that hubcap that flies towards the camera lens. This one also is a highlight for the score during the showdown. It was unfucking touchable. I thought it was amazing. One of the big things I want to talk about is the Toxic Man.
The first time I saw it, even on TV, it wasn't quite as graphic. They did include, I think, water balloon popping on the windshield. And I just remember thinking as a kid, he's turning into something else. You look and you see his fingernails.
Yeah, he looks like a skinny Pizza the Hut or something.
Oh, yeah.
The droopy eyelid was so sick. He's just like, brr.
And he's like, help me. I'm like, who's going to help you? What? It's over, man. I mean,
I love how they just put the label on that tank. It's like toxic waste.
Yeah.
There's really nothing else.
It should have just said Acme with like the Roadrunner in there somewhere.
Exactly. And RoboCop does that like spin move kind of like quick because he can't dive. So right, he's just kind of like, those back doors opening up. Gross.
Oh, yeah.
Nastiness spilling.
According to Verhoeven, is his take on what he calls the American Jesus Christ at the end, where RoboCop's walking across the water, you know, resurrection of Christ, coming back from the dead. It's a whole allegory.
Didn't even pick up on that. That's great.
The confrontation between RoboCop and Clarence. I did think it was kind of interesting that the hand that he kills him with, the one that has the data spike, is the same hand that he shoots off. And I don't know if I'm reading too much into this. His connection to his wife and his kid comes from the data spike because he's looking up the deceased folder for himself and he sees the address. And that's what leads him to his first clue to see his wife and kid. So I thought it was also interesting that the data spike that he kills Clarence with is also his connection with his wife.
Yeah, that is interesting. I actually made a note during the scene when he goes and puts the data spike in. I thought it was really funny when, just in case in 1987 didn't really get what he was doing, there's an ADR line of somebody, one of those tech workers in the back that goes, he's in.
Right.
In case he didn't really know that he was accessing it. Oh, right. He's in. And at the end too, when he puts the spike into the other portal to show the proof to the boss that Dick Jones is bad, the gore on it was awesome.
Yeah.
It's just Clarence's gore. And he's just
backing up 5 seconds. The Ed 209 that gets destroyed. He's like giving him shit about being illegally parked.
Mm. Yes.
Yeah. You like, what the fuck do you do if you roll up and there's an Ed 209?
Is he going to blow your car up?
He has so much more firepower than he's ever been needed for. I mean, urban pacification. Yes. He's checking parking, you know, at the front of OCP.
Dick Jones is like, I have one guarding the building right now.
Right.
And then right after that, he's like, you are illegally parked. Like, that's what you have guarding for. Get out of here.
Jesus. Good Lord, I'm backing up immediately. Backing up to the handgun, the Ed 209 demo was days ago. How is that handgun still in that fucking board meeting, the one he takes the old man hostage with?
Maybe no one wanted to go back in there after that happened.
They're in there now. But, like, it's the same gun.
I guess. Yeah, I don't know.
That was their first board meeting since. They're like, okay, now, thanks for coming back. We've cleaned it all up.
I pretty much think this movie's a perfect film. I will say the one teeny little flaw is the Dick Jones puppet. Do you guys have any thoughts on,
that? Oh, yes. His extremely long reach-around arms. Like, they use the Freddy doll from the first Nightmare on Elm Street, especially because it's like the third to last shot of the movie.
Yeah, I know. It's part of that time capsule charm.
After 2 seconds of the shot, you don't really see how long they are, really. It's like...
Backing up a little bit, when we have the helmet removal sequence, Murphy says, "I had a wife and a son. What happened to them?" And he's speaking about himself in a third person. By that part of the movie, he had not found his true identity. And then the last line of the movie, after he shoots Dick Jones, the old man says, "Nice shooting, son. What's your name?" And RoboCop says, "Murphy." And they go out to end credits, and that Basil Poldoris music just kicks in. It's just a great way to go out to the end credits. Best way to end the film, in my opinion.
Yeah, he has like a little smile, too, after he says Murphy, which is a nice touch. He kind of grins a little bit and then turns.
And then you just have the very big, boom, title screen. It just says RoboCop.
Part of me wishes that they had kept the same look as the very beginning, where it was metallic, instead of just the font on black. But whatever, it works. It's a great impact.
Yeah.
Have you guys seen the remake?
I have not.
I saw it in the theater because my wife loves Joel Kinnaman. I like Joel Kinnaman's work too. She likes him for his work and other things.
Yes.
Other reasons. But, you know, Michael Keaton and Gary Oldman, that got me in there too. Mm-hmm. I was kind of against it. I almost was like, would you mind seeing it yourself? Because I'm kind of like not wanting to go see this. I treasure the original movie. But I went with her and I feel like it was a huge misstep in a lot of ways.
You're going to wait decades, 20, 30 something years to come back and do a remake of something. There should be a reason. And I'm not sure what the reason was for the remake. You know, the first one was so ahead of its time with its cutting edge satire. And it is one of the darkest dark comedies ever. Yeah. And it's super violent, originally rated X. They had to turn it into the MPAA 11 times. I mean, so it was very groundbreaking for its violence. Yeah. We've gotten to a point in movies where there's been so much ground that we've already covered. It's hard to be a pioneer. If you can't do better than the original, which you're already stacked against yourself, if you're going to try to outdo the original, why do it? The film, in my opinion, was different enough from the original, but at the same time, you're just cheating at that point because you're just stealing the fucking name from an IP that's already been established for decades now. And that's just cheating. I didn't really see the point of the film.
Exactly. There was no point, and there was nothing new they brought to it.
Wasn't it PG-13?
That was the other issue.
Yeah, that's it too. It was not memorable at all.
I knew I was in trouble because the beginning of the movie, they have the MGM logo with the lion. And instead of the lion, they have it replaced with Sam Jackson clearing his throat. So it's like, instead of the lion roar. And I knew right off the bat, I was like, if this fucking movie's trying to outfunny the original, it's already fucking doing a horrible job and I'm pissed. And so right off the bat, I knew I was in bad hands. I'm done talking about it. It's not a good film. So I just wanted to know if you guys have seen it. Verhoeven is the first person to show up and accept a Razzie Award in 1995. He won for Showgirls. He won for Best Picture and Best Director. So he was actually the first person to show up and accept it in person.
That's actually great. He showed up.
He was kicked out of Europe for doing such deprived artwork, and then he actually wins awards for it over here. The producer, John Davison, is the voice of Ed 209. It's actually 7 feet tall and weighs 300 pounds. Most expensive set piece on the film was the 6 RoboCop suits. They cost $1 million. Peter Weller lost 3 pounds of water a day in that suit because it was overheated.
Wow.
Took 11 hours to get into the suit. And the catching of the key sequence took 50 takes, which was the entire day's shoot.
What? Okay.
50 takes for catching
just
the keys.
For the thank you.
Anytime you see RoboCop driving or when he's walking around in the dance club, Peter Weller only wore his boxers. He can't sit down in the suit, so anytime he's driving, he's actually just in his boxers.
Kind of makes it a little less
tough when you're
heroic.
When you watch him driving around in that Ford Taurus, now you're going to be like, oh, geez.
That's the first moment of the true commando kicks in, too. Now he's in his boxers the whole time.
Great.
Let's talk about Remington Steele. The original Lewis was Stephanie Zimbalist. Mm. She had the role over Nancy Allen. And the only reason she was cleared to take the role is because at the time, Remington Steele was not getting renewed because it wasn't doing well in the ratings. Brosnan gets the role of Bond. He was getting so much press because of Bond, they renewed Remington Steele, which meant they both could not accept the contracts to do Bond and to do Lewis from RoboCop. We talked about how Paul Verhoeven had wrote the rapist getting shot in the dick sequence. The actor who gets shot in the dick is William Shockley. He plays the rapist in Showgirls also. So he's getting a little typecast
wow.
there.
Man. You're going to be known for something. Yeah. I know. Hey, honey, I'll be back later. I got to play a rapist again.
Rapist right number back. One again on the call sheet.
I got a call back. Oh, that's great. For the rapist?
No. The highway shootout sequence when Boddicker shoves the Bobby body out the back of the van, that was co-directed by Monty Hellman, who is the executive producer for Reservoir Dogs. He did a movie nice. Called Two Lane Blacktop, an old 70s movie.
No.
Yeah, with James Taylor.
Yeah. Yeah.
And one of the guys from the Beach Boys. And they play these like drag racers to go across the country and take people's money from them from drag racing with their badass muscle cars. But he was one of the second unit for that gun shootout sequence. RoboCop's gun is called the Auto 9. It was built from a Beretta 93R and then it was modified. It had to be approved by the FBI for entry into the U.S. because the National Firearms Act of 1934, which defined and regulated any firearm which fires more than one round with a single function of the trigger as a machine gun. So they actually had to get permission from the FBI to actually bring it into the country what? To use it. And it does work. It does fire like 3-round blasts when you just hold it down. That blast, it gets like super close to Kurtwood and to Ray Wise. They actually got $400 extra pay that day for stunt pay because the blast got so close to him. Kurtwood's jacket was singed and was on fire for a little bit. They got an extra $400 of pay for that.
Right before he goes, I like it.
Yeah. It's like right when he shoots that nude, where the explosion like comes right towards the camera. Have you guys seen the end credits Easter egg in small print? It says, this motion picture is protected under the laws of the United States and other countries, and its unauthorized duplication, distribution, or exhibition may result in civil liability and criminal prosecution by enforcement droids.
Oh, no.
No.
I didn't know that.
That's great.
Did you guys say you have or have not seen the KFC commercials?
Peter Weller?
It's really funny KFC commercials. Like, really funny.
Your Kentucky Fried Chicken is delicious. What's the secret recipe?
If I told you, I'd have to kill you. Ha 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 ha. Ha ha ha.
Peter Weller and Nancy Allen were both born on June 24th. They share a birthday.
Maybe wow. That also made their chemistry a little
better. That's cool. Bigger.
Yeah. The 6000 SUX commercial. The T-Rex was animated by Charles and Steven Sciotto. They did the Large Marge sequence in Pee-wee's Big Adventure. Yes. They're also most famous for Killer Clowns from Outer Space, and they did all 270 puppets from Team America.
Oh, wow. That's great.
Wow.
That is great.
Writer Ed Neumeier wrote the script while he was working on Blade Runner. He was a script reader for Warner Brothers at the time, and so at night on the studio lot, they were shooting Blade Runner, so he went down. That's where he got the idea for a robotic cop that was chasing down perps. And he also ended up writing Starship Troopers. We talked about how Schwarzenegger was supposed to be originally the role of RoboCop. That was an Orion request because they were already striking gold with the Terminator movie. Verhoeven, who had worked with Rucker Hauer 3 times prior, really wanted him for the role. And I think he would have made a pretty interesting Murphy, to be honest with you.
It would have been interesting, yeah.
I want to talk about the hostage sequence. That hostage sequence was based on the murder of Mayor George Mascone and city supervisor Harvey Milk. If you remember the movie that came out years ago with Sean Penn playing Harvey Milk and with Brolin playing Dan White, that whole situation is what the sequence was based on.
That's insane.
When Dan White went to trial for murdering these two people, his lawyers did a famous Twinkie defense where he had said that he was eating nothing but candy bars right before he started going crazy. And so in the sequence, you see him eating all these payday candy bars. There's hundreds of them scattered throughout the whole sequence. Based on the Twinkie defense from the Dan White trial. That building that they shoot that sequence in is the Dallas Municipal Building. That is where Lee Harvey Oswald went to after assassinating JFK. He later was killed in the basement of that building that they shoot in.
Oh, wow.
That's where Jack Ruby assassinates him, is in the bottom of that building. And not that I want to tie this in, but just to throw this in there, famously Gary Oldman played Lee Harvey Oswald, who also was a big part of the remake, but whatever, that's a whole other thing. But I just thought it was kind of interesting that hostage
weird
sequence was based
man.
On the Harvey Milk assassination, and that building they shot it in is where Lee Harvey Oswald was murdered.
Oh, that's
so
crazy.
I thought that was fucking nuts.
Yeah, that is insane.
So guys, we've pretty much come to the end. Is there anything we didn't talk about or anything we didn't cover you guys wanted to touch base on?
Since RoboCop is such a classic, I think it's really a shame that the sequels and the subsequent, I don't know how many TV shows there were, they all just really fell flat. Part 2 has its moments, but pales in comparison to the original, and Part 3 is 100% terrible in my estimation. And then all of these attempts at TV shows and miniseries is like zero impact. Nobody talks about them, nobody cares. It's really strange to me that something as popular as RoboCop, they couldn't capture that magic again.
Mark, do you have any final thoughts on RoboCop and why you love this movie so much?
I feel like maybe a reason why it was never able to be duplicated again is because it was, like I said earlier, this type of American excess through the lens of this Dutch filmmaker that is removed from it. Verhoeven puts his take on it as much as he can as a director. And when you have people just trying to carbon copy it, it's not going to resonate as much. If you take the subtleties of the when does one lose their humanity and how much man, how much machine, do his memories have anything to do with his last gasp of humanity? You can't convey that in a series or even multiple movies because you've already done it. So you're only trying to rehash or recreate. The copies get degraded.
A few years ago, very recently, there was talk about Weller coming back for a legacy sequel.
I think Neil Blomkamp wanted to do that.
Where they would bring Weller back and they would progress the story in 30 years into the future. RoboCop would have been dormant for a long period and then they would decide they need to bring him back out. These days, everybody's trotting out these legacy sequels. There's definitely a law of diminishing returns with that. Of course, I would go see Peter Weller put this armor back on, but you always run the risk of falling flat on your face and at best doing a crappy movie and at worst actually tarnishing what has come before. Maybe it's for the best that it didn't happen.
You cannot top a pioneer. You can't rediscover a road better than the person before you. This movie for me has insane amounts of rewatchability. I've probably watched this movie once a year ever since it's been out. This movie never gets boring to me. It has major rewatchability factors. He was my hero when I was 12 years old and he has evolved into one of my favorite intelligent and envelope pushing satires. I love this fucking movie. It's super entertaining. It's got great music. It's got great practical effects. It has a view of the American culture from 87 that was taken from an outsider's perspective. So it says something that I had really never seen or heard before. And I think it's fantastic. Mark, probably the next time you and I will be talking will be for John Carpenter 3.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. Big Trouble in Little China. I've got a couple stories about that from back in the day. I'm just looking forward to it.
Me too, man. I'm excited to talk to you about that some more. I'm having a blast doing that retrospective. It's great. And Jared, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Can you talk to us a little bit about hyperspace for you? Take off.
Not to throw shade at anyone, but we are the only podcast on the internet.
But you are in the future.
Yeah. We broadcast from the 25th century, and there's no podcast there anymore.
Something went wrong at the OCP factory, and
exactly.
Jared and his two castmates are the only three left.
Yes, I do the show with my buddies Matt and Mike. Listeners of this show would probably find something to enjoy in our show. We share some DNA for sure.
Very, very sci-fi heavy. And if you don't mind me interrupting for a second, I will guarantee you, if you're looking for anything, especially Star Wars related, you will never find anybody who knows more about Star Wars than Jared. That's no joke. I've actually seen him take down some serious fucking punks at some Star Wars question and answers with major prizes that were given out. So Jared is the king of a lot of sci-fi, but definitely Star Wars.
Yeah, we're called The Hyperspace Podcasting in the 25th Century. We're going to be talking about Book of Boba Fett.
Can't wait for them.
Dune and some big movies coming out in the fall. And we're going to be talking all about that.
Anything sci-fi. I can't recommend The Hyperspace enough. Anytime they do deep dives or deconstructions, anything Star Wars related, if you're a fan, I highly recommend going over that podcast for sure.
You just struck on an alternate podcast title or another podcast for you. Deconstructing movies. Yes.
Well, yeah. Now I feel like I need to delete the past eight or whatever and start all over from scratch. Jesus.
Deconstructing.
Let's deconstruct. Yeah. Sorry, I just something about
that'll be my catchphrase.
Like, oh. No, that's perfect. That's Jesus. Awesome.
Hey guys, seriously, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate
it. Thank you.
And stick around for our exclusive interview with star Ronnie Cox. I am very pleased to be joined today by Ronnie Cox, the star of one of my favorite 80s films of all time, RoboCop. Mr. Cox, how you doing today, sir?
How you doing?
Very good. First question I had for you, until 1987, the roles you were performing were such a contrast from the Dick Jones character. What was it that attracted you to the project?
Well, in many ways, RoboCop was as big a boon to my career as Deliverance was. Deliverance was my first time in front of a camera. The character I played, Drew, was the sensitive nice guy. And in those days, if you played anyone with any sort of sensitivity, then you could get typecast as sensitive. creativity got equated with weak. So if there was any sort of balls to the character, I often didn't get, and it was frustrating. I'm an athlete. We did all our own stunts, but I was always cast as the nice guy next door or the Mr. Boy Scout nice guy. So I was not what's known in Hollywood as a soft actor. I love the fact that I can play sensitivity, and I reveled in playing those. But it was frustrating to me that I was never offered these other kind of roles. In many ways, I jumped at RoboCop because it gave me a chance. Paul Verhoeven's genius in casting me in that was he wanted to trade on that residual goodwill that people, if they had seen me for 12, 15 years playing this nice guy. So he wanted people to have this feeling that when Dick Jones came on, oh, here's a nice guy. And then when Dick Jones wasn't a nice guy, he was twice as evil. And so for a lot of years, Dick Jones was voted the number one villain in films. And I love the fact of that.
That's a great claim to fame.
Yeah. And so I all of a sudden got offered everything. Because there was a period, I don't mean to brag too much.
No, but go ahead.
I was in every movie made there for a while.
You mentioned Paul Verhoeven. You went on to create another amazing villain with Cohagen in Total Recall. What was your working relationship with Paul? I'm assuming well, since you did two amazing movies together.
Paul Verhoeven and I got along fabulously well. I'm sure you know he's legendary in his volatility.
Yeah.
And the two films I did with him, I never once problem with Paul because he is so volatile and mercurial. A couple of times the crew guys had come to me and said, Ronnie, Paul, he never gets on you. What have you got? Tell you the truth, I don't know. Paul's a very, very intelligent man.
Yeah.
And I think he realized that if he ever went off on me like that, then it would affect my work.
Right.
In a way that was not good. Because some people, he uses that to sort of get what he wants from that person or to get whatever it is he wants. He uses that as a tool. I think he instinctively knew that if he did that to me, that would not further his ends.
Gotcha.
And also another aspect of that, Paul has a PhD in chemistry. My wife was a PhD chemist. Mary got her PhD at Georgetown and did 4-year postdoc at Sloan Kettering in New York. So he and Mary kind of hit it off intellectually well, too.
The film is an extremely dark satire. Did the humor come through on that first script read?
It didn't. When I first read the script and when my agent sent me the script, everybody was laughing about this script. There's this film that's going to be made, RoboCop. It was a fairly low budget film for that time, and we almost lost our funding 3 or 4 times on the film. The reason I jumped at it was because it was a chance for me to play a villain. And I'm not trying to put Ed Neumeier and those guys down. The script is okay. But what made that film really work was Paul Verhoeven. Mm-hmm. He's the one that brought that humor. That film is a triumph of Paul Verhoeven's. And he took it from being a sort of laughable piece of comic trash to being this thing. And the humor, the pathos, everything about that really worked and came through is a direct result of Paul Verhoeven.
The movie says so much about American culture, and to have an outsider director come in and to get his perspective on the type of 80s culture we were living through at the time, it definitely gave a fresh perspective for sure. It was interesting.
Yes, it got rated X
lots
of times. I think the censors at that time hurt the film in a way that they didn't even know. It was rated X for so much blood.
Yeah.
It's in a way they made it worse for the violence than it really was. Because see, what Paul wanted to do originally, he grew up in war-torn Europe, and had seen real violence. And Paul wanted the scenes, especially early on, to be so bloody and so over the top that the viewer would say, oh, I get it. It's
right.
A joke.
Right.
There was just blood rushing down the street. Then the viewer would say, oh, I get it. The censors kept cutting it back, until they made it right on the edge of what really disturbed us.
Yeah.
And so in many ways made it more disturbing than it would have been.
You were talking about some of the more bloodier scenes. The Ed 209 was one of two scenes the MPAA had major issues with. How much of the filming of Mr. Kenny being obliterated were you there for?
I was there.
That must have been a heck of a shoot, man.
Oh, it was. You've never seen so many squibs putting a guy in your life. And even when they shot Dick Jones out of the window at the end, they put those squibs on you. They're little explosions, is what they are. They not only put squibs on front of me, they put squibs on my back as well. And so when they did that, like I said, I'm an athlete. It put me to my knees, and I had to go and throw up in the bathroom.
Oh, man, really?
Oh, yeah. And that's what happened to me.
Mm-hmm. So I can only imagine. That's crazy. I wanted to back up a little bit. What were your initial thoughts when you first saw the RoboCop suit?
I remember the first day we went down because Peter was called in for makeup that first day, and they called him in at, I think, at 6 o'clock in the morning. And at 6 o'clock that night, they finally had him in it. They had not gotten him ready in time to shoot. Eventually, they got it where it could be put together in, oh, 2 or 3 hours. But boy, going through that, it was an ordeal. I've had very little contact with Peter because he and I were almost never, except for when he shoots me out the window, never in the same scene.
Mm-hmm. It's one of the more iconic pieces of the movie is the Rob Bottin effects.
Rob Bottin is just a genius. He just is a genius. And he became like an icon when he was almost a teenager. So he set up his shop and hired and trained all of the guys he grew up with and went to school with. They were his workers.
Mm-hmm.
What a wonderful, wonderful man he was and is. He made the lady with the three breasts.
Yeah, from Total Recall.
In Total Recall. The number of people that went by to feel that breast.
I guess that speaks to its realism, I guess. You've said in the past that reacting is your favorite part of acting. With that in mind, being paired up with Kurtwood Smith must have been an absolute blast for you.
It was. The fun of acting is reacting. It's the same as playing music. The fun of playing music is playing what you're playing and listen to what the other guy's playing back. That's really what acting is all about, is making that connection. And that's the absolute key to acting for me. Now, I don't know if you know this or not, but Kurtwood Smith tested for Dick Jones.
Yeah, I did hear that. Yeah. He killed it as this character. But I mean, just to see you two together was fantastic in those scenes.
As Boddicker, yeah. He was great.
The power struggle between you and Miguel in the bathroom crescendos with you pulling his hair, which was your idea. Can you talk about your process and your ability to see your characters fully formed versus what's in the script, being able to bring things like that to the table?
Miguel adamantly did not want me to grab his hair. By the way, that was one of the absolute first scenes we shot in the whole. So we had no relationship at that time.
Oh, wow. That's a major power play to do that then on first day of shooting with someone.
Yeah, it was early on. Miguel came to me and said, don't pull my hair. He said, because I don't know what I'll do. I said, look, Miguel, I said, you're an actor. I'm an actor. And do what you're going to do. I'm not going to hurt you. You're not going to hurt me. Whatever that does, reluctantly, he went along with it. And later, he came to me and said, thank you for insisting on us doing that. On three separate occasions, they were running out of money on RoboCop. Mm-hmm. And on three separate occasions, the investors came to John Davidson and to Paul Verhoeven and said, cut together your best scene because we got to show something to the investors. And they cut together that scene, Miguel and I, three separate times to keep the movie going.
That's awesome. I love that. That's great. With a movie that was so clearly doing something that had never been done before, what was the vibe on set? Was it confusion or camaraderie? There was a lot of tension?
We shot in Dallas, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, they were having problems with buildings. So a lot of these buildings we were in were old, abandoned buildings that we had to kind of go in and refurbish. And like I said, for a science fiction film, it was pretty low budget.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were a lot of tensions.
I'm obviously an outside perspective, and to see a movie that had commercial break-ins, over-the-top violence mixed with humor, and just things that I had not seen before in movies, was there a clear vision out on set?
No, none of us knew the humanity and humor and pathos that Paul was injecting into that.
Yeah.
It had none of that.
Wow.
It was just making a movie.
RoboCop was treading new uncharted waters. What were your reactions to the critics' reactions of RoboCop when it first came out?
Just for me personally, being a bad guy, was all of a sudden people were looking at me through a completely different lens. And I have to say, it was kind of thrilling.
Have you ever seen RoboCop with an audience before?
We saw it at the screening, but I don't often go see my films just because I never see that guy up there on the screen as an extension of me. It's almost like watching another person. And I say, well, that works and that didn't work. And I'm not one of these people. I don't feel either joyous pride of watching myself or embarrassment of watching myself.
Ronnie, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate your insights and your behind-the-scenes stories. I wish you best success with your movies and your music career, sir. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Right, have a great day. Bye. Once again, I just want to say thank you to all the people that helped make this episode what it was. Our good friends Mark Talley and Jared Tockstein, the amazing Ronnie Cox, and of course, the show's producer, Gigi Lage. If you like what you heard on today's episode, there's tons of ways to keep up with what we're doing. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast, and you can follow us at our official website, sidetracked.stream, or Facebook, or even Instagram. We hope you're enjoying the show so far, and if so, feel free to write us a review. But for now, stay safe. We love you all, and until next time, stay sick.